G'day mate, how you going? This is Adam O'Brien and welcome to Fandom Podcast Network, here where we enjoy all forms of fandom. Well, coming to you live from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia, I bring you Lethal Mullet Podcast, an Australian look at B-grade action films from the 1980s. That's right, going back to that beloved time when we had Chuck Norris on almost every Friday night here in Australia, kicking, punching, and shooting his way to the top, alongside Jean-Claude Van Damme, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the likes of many of the others that came after him, Sylvester Stallone. We even look at some of the heroes you may not know, all here on one fortnightly podcast here on the Fandom Podcast Network. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can check it out also on Podbean if you've got the Podbean app. Make sure you check it out. Now, let's get into the episode here on Fandom Podcast Network.
Alright folks, welcome. Hank Gallen, this is the one, the only, Lethal Mullet himself, Adam O'Brien here at Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia. Here to chat some 80s, 70s, 90s, you name it, action films. Because we celebrate it here on the Fandom Podcast Network. And joining me, all the way from Brisbane, from the Hiscock Home Cinema, is the one, the only, the co-host of My Saga, and of course, one of the most and greatest film connoisseurs in Queensland, Australia, Blair Hiscock. Mate, how are you?
Well, I don't know how to respond to that, Adam. yeah, great to talk to you. It's been a little while since I've been on the show, but yeah, I'm just excited to be here and have a chat about some glorious action movies.
Nice, nice. I tell you, I'm going through a bit of a John Carpenter phase again. I know we did that a little bit earlier in the year together as well, but John Carpenter, only in the last couple of months, has put out 4K re-releases and Blu-ray releases of four of his signature films. One of them is They Live, Escape from New York, The Fog, and the one I've just picked up, Prince of Darkness.
Ah, cool. Excellent. Yep, I actually picked up Escape from New York and They Live when they were first released, and I was really, really impressed with the quality of what they've done, especially They Live. That was just a sensational transfer all around as far as audio and video was concerned. But no, I'll have to check out the other. I haven't seen The Fog for a long time myself, and that's one of my classic favourites in the day as well. I used to watch it every time I was on television years ago.
And it's interesting with that film was a big success for him. And obviously with Halloween and, you know, it's the films that we now are more even, I suppose, more beloved, like things like Big Trouble in Little China and The Thing, which weren't commercially successful at the time, but now are just cultural hits.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, Big Trouble's another guilty pleasure of mine that gets a bit of a spin every 6 months, I suppose. I just love it. It's just so quotable. And I suppose it's probably, I think that's probably Carpenter's most crowd-pleasing venture that he's done with Big Trouble in Little China. And I remember back in the day, I think I saw it about four times at the cinema, and I took, like, different people every time just to experience it, you know, because I love Jack Burton. I love Kurt Russell's character in that. So it's the polar opposite to Snake Plissken, but it does both characters so well.
You know, I think that's a big thing, is you find out very quickly that, you know, Kurt Russell plays Snake Plissken like John Wayne. Clint Eastwood.
Clint Eastwood.
And Wayne is Jack Burton, you know?
That's it. Yeah, sure.
You know, it really is down pat. What's interesting, I find, too, is that these new cuts, we've got some behind-the-scenes features with not only John himself's jumped on there, but also a lot of the people that were in the crews. And there's some really interesting stuff, even with Prince of Darkness. There's a great set tour by a fan who's actually going around to the locations currently, filmed them, showed even some of the scenes as they were shot in the current way they look.
Oh, right. Okay, cool. Yeah, that'd be worth checking out.
Without a doubt. Now, folks, we've got a lot of great movies out there at the cinemas right now, particularly in the cinemas right now is an extended cut, Avengers Endgame. Now, of course, this wipes out pretty much the current story, if you like. Without giving away spoilers, this is a phase that pretty much will get the next round of Avengers starting in its own story, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I think this is one that, you know, it's as long as a Peter Jackson movie, really, when you think about it.
Oh, definitely. But not that you noticed it with The Lord of the Rings, but with Avengers, didn't really notice the running time either. It's so full and so dense, and you think, oh, 3 hours, how am I going to handle that? But I actually saw it today for the second time. I saw it back in April, and my daughter's been away, and she's back for a bit of a mid-year break. So I took her to see it today because she was dying to see it and would have missed out otherwise. And I'd almost forgotten a lot of what happened in the film. And so I just, just enjoyable just to take her along and get her to see it. But yeah, it was great watching it the second time again. And it really fleshed out a lot of things for me that I'd missed the first time. And some of the great dialogue and Tony Stark, some of his little quips and comebacks, which I missed the first time, was great. But yeah, it was great, just seeing it again and really, really satisfactory rounding out of this phase three that we've had in the Marvel Universe.
I think so too. I mean, there's just so much going on in those Avengers movies. Casts are just so big. So even it's hard to get, an opportune moment for one or the other. But I think it's a fine balance.
It was, and what is even more surprising, the film had to be as long as it was to tidy everything up, but what I think's great is everybody had their moment in the sun, all the characters, and which, there wasn't really anybody that I could think of and go, oh, well, so-and-so didn't do much or whatever. I mean, everybody had a successful arc, and it was just really well done altogether. So, I think the Russo brothers did a sensational job, with every Marvel film that they've done. And, I can't wait to see what these guys come out with next.
It's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Obviously, we've got Far From Home out there now as well with Spider-Man.
That'll be the next one, yeah. Oh, yeah. I haven't seen it yet.
What's interesting, even that's going really well over with people. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what's said about that film too is that, this is the front runner for really getting, obviously, the momentum going with the next storyline.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I've been a fan of all the Spider-Man films that have come out. Maybe Spider-Man 3, not so much. But I've been really happy so far with what Marvel have done since he's back in the fold again with the interesting little sharing that they've got to do with Sony to sort of make it happen. I'm really looking forward to for this next film. And, it's going to open up so many doors and I've been told to stay away from social media because some of the things in the film are pretty special. And especially in the end credits, apparently, they said there's some really good stuff there. So I'm really looking forward to... And when my daughter's here for the couple of weeks, we're going to go and see that one again, maybe later in the week. That's definitely the next one to open a whole new Pandora's box. For the next the next 20 films and then the next decade, we're going to have to go through.
Oh, definitely. Now, what's also interesting is that we've had rumblings in TV circles that Brad Wright, producer who worked on MGM's, of course, great series Stargate SG-1, of course, with Richard Dean Anderson, is apparently in talks to basically do the next leg or the future of Stargate. Now, all that's been said so far is that they obviously had recently last year put out Stargate Origins, which was kind of I suppose a 10-piece, 10-minute each short web series, which, to be honest, for the budget it had and everything, was interesting enough for what it was. It's very small scale, low budget, not a lot of effects and stuff like that, but they made it work. I thought for what it was okay. Definitely not a theatrical feature, but MGM and themselves have gone directly to, obviously, Brad Wright and said, well, look, that didn't quite work. We have this property. We want to use it. What is the next step? How do we go forward from here? And I think he's looking at exactly what it is. If you think about it, the storyline really got to in Stargate SG-1 was the public never knew about the Stargate. It was always kept secret. So he said that anything they do will be about the public finding out about the Stargate and what reaction that would have from the public.
Okay. Yeah, personally, I think it's time for Stargate to make a triumphant return. I mean, we had, 10 seasons of SG-1? Mm. And of course, all the other spin-off series, with Atlantis being probably my favourite, of the Stargate series that came out. I just love the characters. But, we definitely we're ready for more Stargate. And Origins, was, like you're saying, an interesting little exercise. I was a little bit disappointed with what I saw of it, but I would love to see them reintroduce Stargate as another feature film, actually, at some stage. There's definitely the scope there, and the universe there is just so lush and just so big. Maybe I think they've been looking at Star Trek Discovery and seeing what's been going on there with Star Trek and with the future of Star Trek and how they're expanding that, with other series and that. And I thought, well, if it's working for them, we can update it as well. So I think that's mainly what they're looking at. And whether or not we see like a series that's sort of set before O'Neill and all those guys or not, but definitely time for to bring it back again.
Be interesting if they did it, like, obviously this one was set in the 1920s, I think, for Stargate. Now there was a story in, I think it was the first season, where we get to see them try, I think it was in the mid 50s or early 1960s, that they sent a guy through the Stargate, but they couldn't bring him back. And he went to the repository of knowledge of all the ancients and stuff like that.
Yeah, I remember that one. Yep.
Yeah, so I have a feeling a 1960s era or something like that of Stargate is an interesting
one. Do the X-Men thing.
Like First Class, Stargate First Class.
Have a young O'Neill or something when he's like, obviously that'll probably go against the things. But what was the name? I can't remember his name now. The Colonel.
General Hammond.
The guy from the John West ad, remember?
General Hammond.
John West ad. General Hammond. Now, have a young Hammond, and that would just sort of play in so well with down the track when he what he knows. And you didn't realise how much what he knew in the original series, but now you do because you've seen what he's done 20 years earlier, or something like that. I'd love to see Stargate in the Vietnam era.
Oh, yeah, it'd be great.
That'd be great,
What's great about Stargate, too, is that they really had down pat what I think the movie should have done, which was explored more what these Goa'uld were, or Gould.
Mm-hmm.
And, we didn't really see that in the movie. You just saw basically possessed kids, possessed... But I like the fact that you actually saw the parasite for what it was.
Yep.
And then we saw these guys that were basically harbouring the infant Gould, so these Jaffa warriors. And I think one of the most interesting things was seeing basically a Spock, if you like, because Teal'c is a Spock character.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, he was my favourite of the SG-1 crew.
Oh, great.
It was Teal'c. He had such a great character, some great character moments in there. And now... there was that episode where they went back to the 60s.
I think
it was in season two.
Yeah.
Season two. And that's one of the ones that, if I want to watch Stargate, that's one of the standalones one I'll put on because I really, really enjoyed that one. And, it's just amazing what they can do, especially now. I mean, we're like 20 years later down the road of technology. I mean, you look at the visual effects in Discovery, and Orville and stuff like that on a television budget. And I think they could do a Stargate now. Holy dooly.
And just the money that could be put in the right place. I mean, I'm watching Stargate currently. I'm up to about season three. And every 2 years I do a full rewatch. And one of the great things about the rewatch is, in hindsight, you can see just how much effort went into these shows and on practical effects budgets too. I mean... there's not a lot of CGI in these. Where there is, it's sparingly, and it's usually with Thor's race, the Asgardians and stuff like that. They have to do a little bit of that. But just the work that went, and also the co-stars that pop up, or even the guest stars. They just had Sam Jones, Flash Gordon, in an episode as a bounty hunter.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, that's the thing, eh? I mean, you see these shows and then you watch other shows and you get into other actors and, and then you don't realise where they got their start. And so when you go back, you go, oh, hang on, there's so-and-so, So that's great. That's right. I didn't realise that Noel Flash was in an episode. I'll have to go check that out.
It is amazing. Now, folks, before we get into our main article here today, where we're going to be looking at two classic science fiction films, which are, I think, two of the most iconic visually. One's very successful, one not so successful. One spawned a TV series, one pretty much made Sean Connery cringe. But I also let you guys know that Blair has actually got some great podcasting you've got to go and check out. And one of those, of course, on Omni FM is the one, the only, My Saga. Tell the folks tonight a little bit about it.
Oh, well, yeah, My Saga is a podcast that Adam Harris and myself do. That we've done now for, it's getting on to 3 years. We try and be pretty consistent with it, but sometimes life gets in the way. We've both been ill in the last couple of months, so we've sort of, you know, had to slow down a little bit. But, yeah, we're getting back up to full speed again with the episodes. And, yeah, basically we just talk about what's happening with the Star Wars universe and the week that was and what we're looking forward to. And, you know, we bring up little stories and little memories. No political agendas involved. Two guys sitting down having a chat, talking about Star Wars and loving it, and hoping that the listeners are loving it too. So, yes, please, please do join in and have a listen if you get the chance. We'd love to have you on board.
Definitely. And can you spare any of these rumours that Mr. Harris is working on a Mad Max documentary?
Okay. Well, he hasn't mentioned it to me, but I don't know that about him. Yeah, Adam Harris produces a Mad Max documentary. Yeah, I'd watch it.
What do you call it? My Mad Max?
Yeah, that's it. Well, I mean, maybe if George Miller ever gets around to making another one, that sort of may spur the desire to see such an endeavour happen. So, yeah.
All right, before we get into the episode tonight, here's where you can catch this show and many others like it on Fandom Podcast Network at fpnet.podbean.com, which is our main master feed. You also catch the actual show itself on the Podbean app. It's one of the greatest ways to check out the show. Also, if you like all the shows, you can catch them at all these different places where you can catch podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and, of course, Google Play if you're an Android user. Now, also, on social media channels, you can find us on Twitter at FanPod Network. And on Facebook, you can catch us at Fandom Podcast Network's page there at facebook.com/FandomPodcastNetwork. If you want to catch us on the email lines, email any ideas you have that the show might be able to cover. Any other films you think that have been fantastic, you can catch us at FandomPodcastNetwork@gmail.com. You can catch me, the host, Adam O'Brien, at obpopculture on Twitter and, of course, on Instagram as well. Same handle. And don't forget to catch me on my other show, The Fantha from Down Under, a fortnightly look at Star Wars from Down Under on Fantha Tracks Radio or FanthaTracks.com. And also check out the great shows that I'm doing here on Fandom Podcast Network's Couch Potato Theatre, where we look at Mad Max with Maximum Couch Potato, and also our brand new show, The Spicing Guild, looking at the adaptations of Frank Herbert's Dune. Now, let's get into the show.
Join Lethal Mullet tonight as the team investigate one of the greatest films from the 1970s. Well before Star Wars was even a thing in people's imagination, there was Logan's Run, 1976 science fiction film which dealt with young people heading towards the carousel before the age of 30 and those that tried to escape, hunted down by the Sandman, starring Michael York and Richard Jordan. And on tonight's episode, Blair Hiscock of My Saga is here to chat about that film.
All right, folks, we're going to get into our main article here tonight, and we're going to first talk about, I think, one of the more successful science fiction films before Star Wars. This is a film which, of course, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer put together with director Michael Anderson in 1976, the amazing Logan's Run. Now, you got to see this in the cinemas, man.
Ah, yeah, tell everybody I'm old. That's great. yeah, I did. I still remember. It was a double. It was actually a double. It was at the Hawthorne Cinema in Brisbane, and I was 10 years old, and it was a double of Logan's Run and Airport 75. If you remember, Airport 75 was the one where the plane sunk to the bottom of the ocean, and they're trying to get everybody out. But the film beforehand, this is back in the lovely day when you used to get two movies at a double session at the movies, and you think back now and you go, gee, how Did your kids keep quiet? How did our bladders handle that? You know, but. But yeah, Logan's Run was the first film, and I can remember sitting there watching it, and just as a 10-year-old, and it just completely took me over, completely blew my mind, and my parents took me, and they were a little bit concerned when Jenny Agutter's breasts were shown. I can remember Mum was a little bit, oh, what's going on here, you know. And I'm 10-year-olds going, oh, yeah, that's interesting. But now the film was just, is, and to this day, is such a fantastic piece of world building. And I've always been a massive fan of Logan's Run. And I'm actually one of the people who really don't want a reboot because it was such an iconic look. It's just an iconic vibe. And Michael York as Logan was just great. I mean, he's sort of, you know, not the actor you would tend to think in a role like that if they remade it today, you know. I think he played the part well, and I think everybody involved played the part well. And yeah, it was just one of those rare films that completely took you over. It was shocking, it was freakish, it was exciting, and had humor in it. And the visual effects today, I mean, yeah, are dated, but you still get the vibe of what they were going for.
And, of course, it spurned a TV series as well after.
It did, yeah, yeah, that's right. I can just remember the series. I don't remember too much of what... I remember it used to be on in the afternoons sometimes after school. But, yeah, I can remember being a bit annoyed that Logan wasn't the same guy as the film. And that's right, and Jennifer was completely... That's right, he had the robot too, didn't he? He had the fellow who was the robot. Yeah, that's right. But the original film, yeah, and that's another one that either I'll watch it when it's on television or put the Blu-ray on. When I feel like a bit of a nostalgia trip.
That's right. Now, if you folks haven't seen this movie before, it's set in the year 2274, where basically human civilization's in a sealed city.
Well, I mean, I actually made a film myself back at film school back in the 90s called 5 Seconds, and which I also stole heavily from Logan's Run, and everybody who worked on the film with me just didn't realise, think what an original work of brilliance it was, and then they saw Logan's Run and went, you mongrel. Hey, I got top marks for the movie, but yeah, that was pretty cool. But anyway, Logan's Run, and that's the thing that amazed me with it, was that, like, the carousel sequence, the thing of Ali having to age till 30, and you had the little life clock in your hand
that's
where
right.
It blinked different colours as you got to different ages, and when it started flashing red, it was your time to go to carousel and attempt to have a go to reach another life to like, reset and to be reborn, essentially. And that entire carousel sequence, if you've ever seen it, it's, people all dressed up in very weird-looking costumes and all have to fly and try and reach this light to be reborn. And they can't, you know, they're like getting destroyed as they're trying to get it. And it's like the ones reaching for the top and the whole crowd is just cheering them on, the people who are left to go and get that and strive for the golden ring, if you will. And as a child, that spun me right out, that entire thing. And it's something, it's seriously, it's a scene, it's an image that to this day I can remember just, you know, freaking me out, that stayed with me, you know, that entire thing. Brilliant concept. I remember I read the novels. I had all the Logan's novels back in the day, but in the books it was different. It was 21 was the age that you had to reach. So it was nice that they actually gave him another 9 years of life in the film, you know, to make it to 30, but... like I say, incredible world building and just the imagination, especially for the time and the budget.
It's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Now, the film came out in June 1976 in the US and brought by United Artists in both Canada and the States. But what a great thing about this is, when it came out to Australia, obviously it was universal like anything. You basically got the idea of this story. And it really, you think about it, it's influenced a lot of films. It influenced, I think, The Matrix even, the way that you're awakening to basically a prison. And, you know, you have to break yourself out of it. And it starred Michael York as Logan 5, Richard Jordan as Francis 7, Jenny Agutter as Jessica 6, Roscoe Lee Brown as Box. Also, Farrah Fawcett was in it as well.
But that was the first role, actually, I think.
Yeah.
It was the doctor's assistant, that's right, in Logan.
That's right. So, I mean, this is a film also that had been, you know, around trying to get the actual adaptation since 1969 going.
Yep.
So, you know, you think about back in those times, to get a science fiction film movie going, especially the time of, like, 2001, Planet of the Apes, would have been hard.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, real hard, yeah. And that's the thing, because we were so starved for sci-fi back then. You know, you had your, like you said, you mentioned 2001. I mean, that was the biggie, and Planet of the Apes, of course. You had your Planet of the Apes movies, and that's the sort of sci-fi that we were sort of exposed to. Then this thing, Logan's Run, came. And, you know, let's face it, it was the year before Star Wars, you know, and a lot of people, you know, like Star Wars wiped everything out once that came out. But you remember there's this little film, Logan's Run, that came out a whole year beforehand, and just, I think, in a way, really whet the audience's appetite for what was to come, like with Star Wars, greased the wheels, if you will, for what they were going to see the next year. And so, yeah, I actually credit Logan's Run a lot to installing in audiences some interest in sci-fi that Star Wars was able to come in and just run with. So, yeah, it's just a great film.
I think one of the things that gets me is the, you know, it's a real, what's the word? I think, you know, utopia that they've made in this dome sort of structure. But also, one of the great things about it is we get to see, you know, the darkness of these sandmen, basically, and how they're dealing with how do you basically govern this, how do you police it. And, of course, the action scenes in this, I swear it was a hotel, I think it was shot in, looked like a
shopping center.
Shopping center, yeah.
Yeah, defunct shopping center, yeah.
And I think it added to the atmosphere to have this sort of, at the time, would have been a very futuristic look.
I love Francis, the character of Francis. He was just such a conflicted character. And obviously, you know, you'd be programmed, you're brought up, you're programmed to do what you've been told, working for the man, so to speak. And it was right and true and everything. And then when you all of a sudden, your entire life's a lie, and you get exposed to it, and Francis, you know, had to basically betray his best friend, you know, with in Logan. And it's out of all the characters, I think Francis's arc is probably the most satisfying as far as, you know, the character. And he just played it so well. And the actor, I can't remember, what was his name again?
Richard Jordan?
Yeah, I mean, of course, then he was in Dune, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
Gurney Halleck?
Duncan Idaho.
Duncan Idaho, that's right.
Yeah.
And I can remember seeing Dune for the first time. That's Francis! I was such a big fan. He was such a great actor. But, there again, I mean, you know, what really sells it, and what really sells a science fiction movie with a limited budget really well is always the performances and the characters. If we believe that the actors believe it, then you've won half the battle. That's the thing. And such great performances from so many good actors in that film.
Oh, without a doubt. Now, obviously, it also has, you know, been probably, I suppose, known more also for the outfits itself, the look.
Yeah.
The costume design itself is something that straight away, once you see that sort of black outfit with a little stripe across it, it straight away, I think Michael York, you know, like it's instantaneous.
Yeah, that's it, and that's it's that whole, you know, mental thing of there. It portrays everything. They're basically the police force of this world, and judge, jury, and executioner, really. So, you know, a sandman instills fear and respect. You know, and you look at, you know, scenes in the beginning of the film when he and Francis were good friends. You know, they had the best of everything. They had the best units. They had the best women. They had the best, you know, everything that was put on for them, because they had this job to do in the computer, so to speak, or whoever was running the city. You know, basically the respect was given to them, and because of the job they had to do.
That's amazing. And I think the two, I mean, you look at, again, a time where science fiction didn't have CGI, so they had to really rely on what was around them. They had to look at sets.
I mean, you look at the city today in the film, especially on Blu-ray, you know, where you see every paint mark and everything on the model and that. Yeah, it's definitely, you know, small model work, the scale of the water always gives it away. And that time there's like, you know. But, yeah, I mean, it really, is a, you know, not leave your brain at the door, but immerse yourself. Yeah, you can immerse yourself in the world because it's just so well constructed.
Oh, definitely. And of course, it's one of those things that once, Logan, is basically shown what the reality really is, you know, and the awakening, if you like. You know, it's like any of these other movies that have been spurned on by it, obviously. But I think, yeah, for its time, this is probably the quintessential science fiction film of the 70s.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, you know, like I said, Star Wars became its own beast, but and then basically everything after, well, you know, you had Close Encounters, and Close Encounters is science fiction, sort of, I suppose, in a way, but it's still grounded in a modern time, you know, with modern man dealing with the situation. So as far as like pure science fiction, yeah, probably Logan's Run would be the film of the 70s with that, because anything, you know, after Star Wars, you know, is basically a clone of that for a while too. So it was variations on a theme, but yeah, so yeah, but Logan just stands aside
without a doubt.
For all the latest, greatest news, reviews, and of course, the latest pop culture, tune in to Culture Clash here on the Fandom Podcast Network, hosted by Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel and Kyle Wagner. G'day, mate, how you going? Well, I hope you like Highlander, the amazing Christoph Lambert movie, and of course the sequels and the TV series, because here on Fandom Podcast Network, Kevin the Raider Nerd Reitzel takes you all the way through with Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast.
Zardos speaks to you, and the gun is good, the podcast is good, and it stars Blair Hiscock of My Saga.
Yeah, folks, that brings us to a not-so-successful film, an Irish science fantasy film by the name of Zardos. And, of course, Zardos is quite a strange film, directed by John Borman, starring Sean Connery, a second film after his last at the time Bond film. And starring Charlotte Rampling, Sarah Kestelman, and basically this is shot in such a bizarre way, the film feels like you're on LSD watching it.
Yeah, at least.
it is a post-apocalyptic Earth. It's 2293, and the population is actually divided up. I suppose it's a little bit like science fiction novels. You could be a little bit like Lord of the Rings or Dune in this way, where it's got different classes here. So you've got classes that call the Eternals and mortal ones, which are basically called Brutals. And the Brutals live in a wasteland away from where the Eternals have got their own life, and they live apart in a place called the Vortex, and leading sort of a luxurious and aimless existence, if you like. But it's Zed, played by Sean Connery, who's basically your Luke Skywalker, if you like, or heroic character in this, who is awakened by Zardos himself to basically go on a search for truth. But let's just say this film, which was an aborted attempt at the beginning of John Borman finally trying to get Lord of the Rings out there, this turns into something completely different.
Oh, different's not the word. Oh, I haven't actually watched it for a while. A couple of years ago I put it on. But, you're right. It's just out there. Like a lot of John Borman's films are, he likes to sort of push the envelope with things. And when you actually watch Zardos now, you can actually see the seeds of Excalibur. 8, 10 years or 15 years down the track, with that, and I always laugh now when I love what Connery. Yeah, besides his fantastic pair of speedos that he has to wear, it reminds me of like a young Ramirez, from Highlander. In the part, but like you said, it's a film that's just out there. I mean, when you've got floating godheads All sorts of stuff going on. And, I don't think I've ever watched it all in one sitting. You know, I've sort of watched half of it. It's gotten too much, and I've come back and watched part two or whatever. But, yeah, it's been a good couple of years since I've actually sat and watched it. So my memory of it's probably a little bit fuzzy, but it certainly left an impression.
I suggest having a good wine or a good lager when watching this one, because it will help put the pain to the head of this thing, I tell you. But, you got characters like Niall Buggy playing Arthur Frayne, who actually is Zardos. Obviously, there's a bit of a reveal about Zardos not being exactly really a god in this. Spoiler.
Wizard of Oz moment.
Yeah, I wonder if that might have something to do with the title name. But what's interesting about that he's got a painted-on goatee and moustache, facial hair.
Okay.
He's got I don't know why. It's very bizarre. Like, it's one of those many reasons this... Like at the start, the godhead's floating in the highlands of Ireland, and the gun is good, and all of a sudden,
that's right.
The head starts spewing out rifles and handguns and grenades, and it goes, "To kill is good," all that. Oh god, just absolutely bizarre. That's maybe what this movie should just be called, is bizarre. But to see Sean Connery himself just running around with a handgun and the red Speedos. and trying to make a sense of this. I mean, of all people to choose to do a movie like this, Sean Connery.
Well, I mean, I'm surprised. I mean, look, he got $1 million for the last Bond film that he did, which he gave to charity. Yeah. So I'm often wonder if Zardoz, did he have the same sort of deal? Because you wouldn't read that and go, yeah, that's something I want to do. Yeah, you know, give me a gun and a red Speedo and, great, if he wanted to go something completely opposite of Bond, he certainly chose the right role with that one, that's for sure.
And, I mean, the director himself is quoted as saying that Connery had stopped doing the Bond films and he wasn't getting any work, so he basically came along and decided to do it, cut a lot of costs and stuff like that, and just did whatever he could. But it's interesting, this is just on the Wikipedia trivia of it. It was reported that Stanley Kubrick was an uncredited technical advisor on the film.
Oh, okay. Well, it's sort of got Stanley's sort of mark all over it too. Ooh, when you look at if I didn't know John Bourne or anything, you told me Stanley Kubrick about it, I'd have believed it. it wouldn't be so far a step from Clockwork Orange.
That's right. Now, I mean, the film itself, you wouldn't call it an adventure. It's certainly a bit of a it certainly hurts your head trying to think about what happens in this movie and how it works. I suggest watching it twice if you're going to give it a shot there, Lethal Mulleters. Because, look, at the end of the day, there's parts of this that are actually pretty good. There's part of what John Boorman's trying to do kind of succeeds with the whole idea of taking a godhead and basically showing the reality of things and followers and worship and stuff like that. But also, the fact that to live a life fully is one of the themes here, but I don't quite think it gets pulled off with the film that's being made here.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to, you got me intrigued again. I'm actually going to put it on again and actually try and watch it all the way through for once. But it might be a little bit of a viewing tonight once everybody's gone to bed and they're not going to come downstairs and go, what the heck are you watching? Oh, gosh, have you lost your mind? So, yeah, it might be a bit of a 11 o'clock little sesh for me, I think, but I'll definitely give it a go.
It's one of those movies that should only be on at, 2 in the morning or something like that.
I've had a big night out and you're coming home. At this age, there's not too many big night outs anymore, so, excellent.
It was released on February 6, 1974, and premiered in both Los Angeles and New York. With a runtime of 102 minutes, so honestly, folks, if you're going to get into it, it's not too bad. On a budget of only $1.5 million. So how they got that huge godhead and all that done for that money, surprising, because they really made that size.
Okay.
Oh,
maybe $1 million for Connery and $200,000 to make the film.
I suspect that a lot of people weren't paid on this film.
No, it looks like a labour of love, really. And it does have that sort of, a film school type sort of vibe on a multi-million dollar budget. So, definitely. But, that's great. It's just something that basically challenges you and opens your mind. And yeah, that's what cinema should be about. And at the end of the day, Zardoz is pure cinema.
Oh, definitely. And this film, obviously, too, is one that's been often, I think, parodied sometimes. And Sean is one that won't talk about it. It's one of these films that, we don't talk about this film, you know, the Spiedos and the Gunsh. You know, like, it's certainly not one that you're going to see him go around. But I think if you're a Sean Connery fan, and you know the time where he hadn't quite done The Man Who Would Be King, I don't think, was that 1970? I can't remember. But we're talking about a time where he was starting to head towards a little bit more success again, obviously leading up towards his Labour of Love as well, which was playing Malone in Untouchables. I think the great thing about it is we're starting to see a guy who had it all with Bond, lost it when he left. And I think that's the same with all the Bonds. You know, they sort of fall off the wagon a bit as far as career. And then they start to build that again. And I think it was the World War II films that they started to do together with Michael Caine and obviously all those great actors, Gene Hackman. And those huge ensembles, I think, are what steered him back into A-grade cinema.
Yep, for sure. Yeah. Oh, he's it's funny, you know, you look at this end of his career. I mean, the guy hasn't done a movie since 2002.
Yep.
And that was a terrible film to go out on.
Oh, yes.
I always wish, Sean, you should have, you know, gone. But, when you basically, because for me, he never really left, you know, as you grew up. There's always a film that Sean was in. And one of my favourite films, Connery films, is Meteor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember seeing that when I was 12 or 13 when that came out. And that was a big thing, big school holiday movie. And I knew that he was Bond, but, you know, I was young at the time and that.
What's great is that, like you say, like that Blade was a great film. I think the director obviously knew how to create that sort of comic book feel. But to go into League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, I think maybe even that film should have been more of a classic Connery style, less of that, you know, trying to do the comic book take.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was in the infancy of the comic book resurgence that we're seeing too. I mean, we had X-Men in 2000, and that was really, the ensemble sort of a superhero movie that sort of made good, and it was obviously riding on the coattails of that when it came out. I actually don't mind the film in some parts of it, but it is, at the end of the day, you know, pretty forgettable. I like the idea behind it. Then, of course, we had we had X-Men 2 and away things went, you know, from there. And it was the same year Spider-Man came out that year as well, 2002, didn't it, the last film?
It did, yeah.
But it did, yeah. But, it was one of those, watch and forget sort of things, really.
And I think the thing is, at the end of the day, it was one of those where anything Alan Moore was just done, you know. I think the holy grail was Watchmen, but at that time, they just didn't know how to do Dr. Manhattan and stuff like that.
Well, that's it. I mean, I just loved the concept of the thing. It was like you had the X-Men with the classical literature characters, you know, Invisible Man and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I actually, I wanted to see the sequel because I'd read the comic, and it was actually the book of, I think it was this one, actually ended with the War of the Worlds. It actually ended with the Martians arriving at the end of it, and I thought, wow, that's the movie I want to see. I want to see him taking on H.G. Wells' Martians. Would be fantastic, you know. Obviously it was what it was, and you know, unfortunately it was Sean's last hurrah. And he didn't really go out on a high, but he went out with his head in the air and his fist held high. So he had a fantastic career, and bring on the golf course.
Oh yeah, I mean that's his new career, is getting that golf game where he wanted it, you know, and all the luck to him as well. Of course, I think he chatted to Michael Caine recently, because Michael Caine said in an interview he'd actually talked to Sean about whether he would, you know, ever make a comeback, and Sean said he's just having too much fun in retirement, that he'd go through all the rigors of acting.
He'd be nearly 90 now, surely.
Yeah, he wouldn't be young. Like, honestly, like, you know, he's, well, I'm only looking at Harrison Ford's age the other day, and he's, what, 12 years his senior? Not even that?
Harry is, he'll be 76. 76 or something, I think. Yeah. I'm a 76. Good grief, you know. And, all the heroes are getting old, man. You know, that's the way of the world. I mean, I was a little bit, that's a little bit disappointed with the last indie that Sean didn't make an appearance. You know, they actually wrote him in the film, but he decided, you know, what he said, if there was any movie that could bring him back, would have been Indiana Jones. But thing, he's had too much of a good time retired. And he don't need the money. Gosh, you know, and he's an old man. Come on. The guy break.
No, that's right. Now, folks, I've got to say, on our last episode, we had, of course, co-owner of this channel, the one, the only Phantom Podcast Network's Kyle Wagner on the show. We looked at a lot of breakfast programming of America and Australia, and of course, they wouldn't have grown up in the States with what we did, but we tracked down, through the internet, Boris from Boris's Breakfast Club.
Oh, yep.
And believe it or not, he's still out there.
He is. I had friends who knew him really, really well back in the day. Because, Boris was huge.
Huge, you know? Right? I
remember me growing up, he was, in Brisbane anyway, he was more of a Brizzy boy than the rest of Australia. But, he was Boris the Black Knight, and I always remember... the beginning of his show was always filmed down at Miami at the castle that used to have the big slippery slide on the hill at Miami. Magic Mountain. Yeah, yes. And that was his. I went down that slide many times growing up. Burnt my leg is a classic on one summer's day. I remember it was so hot. But we were tough back in the '80s. I tell you, we were tough kids back then. But I always remember thinking, you know, that was Boris's castle because. That was always used at the beginning of his shows. But what was his name? Eric Boris. Oh, I can't remember his surname now. Eric. I know his first name was Eric.
Eric, yeah. The great thing about Eric was that he was a magician as well as an entertainer.
He was, yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
So what I do remember is the end of the show where he was always falling into a pond and coming up and squirting out water.
And he'd spit the water out. Oh, good old Channel 7.
That's right. You gotta love it. And on Channel 9.
Well, I mean, it's funny, you know. I mean, you know, kids around the world always have these similar nostalgic sort of warm, fuzzy pangs for things that they grew up watching on TV. And it just goes to show how many hours our parents sat us down in front of the box as we grew up to keep us quiet, you know. And people like Boris the Black Knight were our babysitters, you know. And I'm sure it's the same throughout the world with everybody. So, very, 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 very happy memories of old Boris.
And, I mean, that brings up another one that we've looked at here just on the Gold Coast. We were looking on Netflix the other day and just some of the shows that, turning up. I had to then go on YouTube and basically look at some old, we're talking about probably early 90s to mid-90s, comedians, magicians, all that sort of stuff. And one that came up was The Amazing Jonathan. And I don't think a lot of people remember Amazing Jonathan, maybe outside of Australia and the US, but he was a frequent guest on Hey Hey It's Saturday out here in Australia. Yep. And he's a guy who basically was on almost every second week because I think he married an Australian lady and was based more here than in the US at the time. But a lot of those gags and stuff like that he was doing for years and then basically moved to, I think, Vegas. Did a lot of his shows there. But now he's back and he's doing quite a little bit more on YouTube. You can actually find a documentary that has been made about an Australian friend of his who ended up being a fan at first, but then actually, as the influence of Jonathan, made him become a magician himself and basically a comedian. So it's funny, this partnership grew out of something and now... years later, they're rekindling their friendship and because he's had a bit of ill fate with his health, but right. He's on the mend.
Okay, cool. So, I do remember him. I think back when he was probably on the show, I was probably in my late teens, early 20s and heading out in the town most Saturday nights doing stuff. So I didn't sort of see him every week that he was on, but I do remember him being on Hey Hey It's Saturday. So
nice.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yep.
It's brilliant. Now, folks, obviously, Phantom Podcast Network, you're going to find quite a bit of stuff out there for you to check out. Lethal Mullet's only one of those shows, but obviously, Blair, you've been on quite a few of these too yourself.
I'm always happy to come on and have a bit of a yarn about especially 70s and 80s sci-fi and action cinema is a bit of a guilty pleasure subject of mine that I love to discuss. So, yeah, look forward to having a bit more a chat from now and again, and see what the future holds. So, yeah, just good to mix things up a bit amongst all the Star Wars talk that we do.
Definitely. Now, folks, obviously, My Saga you can catch on iTunes and all that, but where can they find you and find My Saga on social networks so they can follow your stuff?
Well, My Saga is on Facebook. Just search for My Saga. It'll come up with our page there. And I'm just under my name, Billy Hiscock, if you want to send me a bit of a friend request and whatever, and I'll get you on board. We'll get you on our mailing list as well for My Saga, and where you'll get the episode link sent directly to you.
For all the latest, greatest news, reviews, and of course, the latest pop culture, tune in to Culture Clash here on the Fandom Podcast Network, hosted by Kevin the Raider Nerd, Reitzel, and Carl Wagner.